You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Anton Duplessis from Zinwald joins us now on Mining Matters. He's here to talk to us about lithium and various aspects pertaining to it. Zinwald has a project in Germany that it's advancing at a reasonably steady rate. So we'll hear about that in a minute. But first of all, we'll talk about lithium, I think, for a bit, Anton. What is it, first of all?
So lithium's a very light metal. It's, in fact, the metal that has the greatest electrochemical potential in the periodic table. So, and what that really means is it can contain the most charge per unit of weight. And it's a sort of a vital component in a lithium ion battery. That's the primary usage. It's also used in a few other things, like making glass and in making certain industrial greases and the like. But over the last decade, I would say the primary use has become to make lithium ion batteries, which there are a number of different battery chemistries out there that use different components or different elements, but lithium ion is sort of probably the primary one that people think about when they think about batteries for use in electric vehicles and grid storage and even in your phone or laptops and so on.
And it's reasonably abundant, I think, sort of speaking generally, but the question is, of course, whether you can mine it economically. And I think many investors will have seen that it comes in a form of Li2O. I think I've got that right. What's the significance of that, of mining Li2O as opposed to the element itself?
Well, I mean, it's just the kind of form it takes when it oxidizes. So I wouldn't get too hung up on that. The actual form that it's sold in for battery use is typically either lithium carbonate or lithium hydroxide. So these are just sort of molecules of lithium in different forms. You'll see it often quoted as Li2O when you think about grade and the like, but there's no sort of specific convention around it.
So you have to process the actual lithium out of the lithium oxide once you've mined it.
Correct. Yeah. So you mine the ore, and then in fact, it's their processing route, which is kind of almost the most difficult thing. As you very rightly said right at the beginning, lithium is a very abundant element within kind of the Earth's crust, but actually mining it economically, so finding it in economic sort of deposits concentrations is challenging, and then processing it in an economic fashion is even more challenging typically. So it's a little bit, if you think about, it's not a rare earth, but if you think about as an analogy, rare earths, they're not that rare, but it's the processing of those materials into a useful end product that's the challenging part. I think, that's the key. I mean, and when we think about certainly, our project and other projects out there, it's kind of extracting the material and then taking it to a useful end product is what the difficult thing is.
So let's talk about the processing in a second, but we can talk about the mining at this point. So I think there are two sort of commonly understood ways of mining lithium. You may want to add more to the list, but people understand that lithium comes in brines and in hard rock, and spodumene is usually mentioned, in this context. What's the difference between mining lithium in brines and in hard rocks? I mean, there's some obvious differences, but why don't you sort of run us through some of the ramifications of these different types of mining?
Sure. So with brines, effectively what you're typically doing is extracting sort of briny the liquid, effectively a salty liquid, typically from an underground aquifer. And then the original kind of sources, or the large brine sources, are in South America, primarily in Chile. And what they do is they put them in large pan, they pump out the liquid, they put it in large pans on the surface, and then the kind of moisture evaporates. You're left with a salt, which then contains lithium and is subject to further processing. So that has the advantage of to have to sucking water out of an aquifer is potentially easier than mining hard rock. You have less waste to deal with in that, but it's obviously very water intensive, and a lot of those operations are up in the Atacama, where water is at a premium. The other thing is if you can't evaporate the water, so if you're in a that works well if you're in a desert environment. There are some other brine operations that are trying to exploit geothermal brines in other parts of the world, and the challenge they have is A, they don't have the surface space for large evaporation ponds, and the climate is typically not well suited to that. There's too much rainfall to make that a viable option, and they're exploring other technologies to extract the lithium from those brines. But I'd note that none of those operations are yet in commercial scale operation. So that's brines. On the other side, you have hard rock operations. I'd say that the bulk of those in the world today are in Australia. So mining spodumene, they concentrate. So they mine that, they crush it, they concentrate it, typically in a dense media separator, and then that concentrate is transferred to a further processing site, with the bulk of those being in China. So a lot of logistics in that, but that's a fairly well-trialed path. And I'd say, it's probably slightly more material is coming from the hard rock route than the brine route in the market today. And whether that shifts around will depend really on how some of these direct lithium extraction technologies develop over time.
And how do you go about finding a lithium deposit? Are there any particular tricks associated with lithium that you might not associate with other commodities, or is it sort of the same methodology?
It's the same methodology of exploration, drilling and so on. I mean, in our case, there had been historic mining in the area where we are. So it was the tin tungsten mining region for actually many hundreds of years. Quite often, tin and tungsten are co-located with lithium. So, what we were aware that well, previous explorers were aware that there was lithium there, and then we, as others would ran an extensive exploration campaign to prove up that resource. So, much the same methodology as you use for any other mineral.
So you get your deposit. You've got a reasonable understanding that there's lithium there. And if it looks like it's going to be economic and you start mining it, is there any unusual aspects to mining lithium, or is it similar to other mining projects as well in terms of drill and blast, open pit, those kinds of things?
Yeah, so it's conventional mining. So in our case, we will be an underground mining operation. That's a little bit driven by where we are. So within Europe, large scale open pit mining is challenging from a social acceptance point of view, because of the impact on the environment. So we will do it in a sort of large scale underground mining, which has the benefit of of leaving less impact on surface. But other mines around the world, in Australia, a lot of those are open pit. So it's whatever's most economic to extract the material. I mean, typically grades in lithium are quite low, so you need to process a lot of material to extract a useful quantity of kind of saleable end product. So you have to bear that in mind. But it's conventional mining. It's just what suits the deposit best. In our case, we've got a large, fairly homogeneous deposit, which lends itself to bulk scale mining. Some of the spodumene operations are more kind of veiny in nature, and obviously, that brings its own challenges. But there's nothing un particularly unusual about mining lithium versus other mining, mining of other commodities.
So thinking about lithium as a battery metal, one point I'd just like to establish is there any are there any different types of lithium? I only ask because if investors are aware of graphite, there's a certain issue there related to flake size, and that's important to pay attention to. Is there anything comparable when it comes to the product that lithium miners like yourselves are hoping to produce?
I mean, so lithium for battery use is all about purity and minimizing certain kind of deleterious elements that might be there. So I guess what might distinguish one deposit from another deposit is what other metals and elements are present. So if there's magnesium or rubidium or things like that, you want to minimize those things, and so it kind of goes to the complexity of the processing. So one deposit might have relatively few of those things, which would imply potentially a simpler processing route, whereas others would have more of those things, and you have to reduce their presence in your final product. So I think that's really the difference.
So, I mean, that reminds me that some companies that I'm aware of actually mine lithium in conjunction with some other metals as well. I mean, I think tantalum is, there's an example in southwestern Africa, I think, where there's a tantalum mine that has some lithium associated with it. And, given that the lithium price did go on a good run a few years ago, they sort of worked out how to get the lithium out. And so you can have more than one product from a lithium mine.
100%. I mean, Greenbushes, which is one of the longer running hard rock lithium mines, it's in Australia. That was originally a tantalum operation, and there are a few other examples of that around the world. So, in kind of assessing the economics of these operations, the byproducts are a very important part of that. And some of them occur because of what the minerals that naturally occur in the deposit alongside the lithium, and others stem from the processing route. But trying to maximize the revenue from what you're doing is an obvious objective of really any mine, but especially in the case of lithium.
Absolutely. So, have you got any other elements at your project?
We do. We have a bit of potassium, which is useful in making high quality fertilizers. So we will produce a bit of that. We also have fluoride. So we'll be able to make a bit of calcium fluoride, which is again something that's in good demand. And then based on our kind of processing route, there are a few other byproducts that are useful. So calcium silicate is one, and then really kind of what would typically be waste streams from the process have a potential use in our case as well. So one of the sort of key waste streams from the chemical processing part of our process is a mineral called analcime, which has the potential to be used as a clinker substitute in cement. And then the main side stream from the mineral processing circuit is a fairly coarse ground quartz sand, which is a useful product for construction. And the key here, I think, what's perhaps a little bit different for us in terms of those things than someone mining in Western Australia, for example, is we're relatively close to markets that can use those. So those are not high value products. So transport cost is an essential component in determining whether they can be useful. And we're 35 kilometers from a fairly big city. We're in Germany, which where there's a lot of construction and so on. So those things are potentially useful byproducts for other industries. And the advantage for us is not only does it give us some revenue, or has the potential to give us some revenue, but it also deals with what would otherwise be fairly significant waste streams. So if we can sell those to other industries, it means less material that we have to deal with from a waste perspective. So that's pretty important. And it's kind of on these things that you seek to optimize the projects.
So I guess there's a trade-off there. I guess it's, I mean, it sounds in a way complicated to produce more than one product. But on the other hand, what you're saying is actually, if you produce more than one product, you're producing less waste. So there's more of an economic return on that. So you sort of have to weigh that sort of up, the pros and cons of all those different inputs and work out what is the most beneficial way to proceed.
That's 100% correct. So, I mean, some of them you will have regardless because you start with a certain amount of material, and the lithium is a relatively small component of that. So you will have other material to deal with, and then it's a as you rightly say, it's a case of looking at, okay, what is it going to cost us to get that into a suitable form that it becomes saleable? What is the additional cost? What's the additional complexity, and these kinds of things. And you seek an optimum around those. There's no single right answer. It's more an engineering optimum and
Yeah,
an economic optimum.
absolutely. So, but nevertheless, the main product that we're talking about is lithium. So, the plan will be to produce a concentrate, I guess. I mean, that seems to be what most, certainly the smaller miners, the smaller operators in the lithium space seem to all, in the hard rock space, seem to produce a concentrate and then ship it. And you mentioned that most of the concentrate goes to China. And that presumably is because China just has the most processing capability compared to anyone else.
So that's how it's been historically. So in our case, that's not our strategy. So we will produce to a battery grade end product. That's the ultimate plan. And the reason for that is several fold. So first, the material that we're mining is not a spodumene. It's something called a zinnwaldite, which is a lithium containing mica, and it requires a similar but different processing route to spodumene. So there isn't a kind of world market for a zinnwaldite concentrate at the moment. So to produce to just a zinnwaldite concentrate is not optimal. And then you get significant savings in terms of logistics if you can produce all the way to an end product very close to the mine site. Now, in the case of an Australian spodumene producer, that's a less obvious thing to do because A, those mines are already quite a long distance from kind of any industrial site typically. There isn't a domestic battery industry or even a much of a domestic automotive industry in Australia. So you don't really have the end market there. So for us sitting in Germany, that's all very different, right? So there is a battery industry in Germany. There's a battery industry in the EU. Those are industries that are seeking to expand and grow. Automotive is a massive industry in Germany. And then the other thing you have in Germany that you perhaps don't have in certain other places where lithium is mined is quite a big industrial chemical industry, which is almost the most important skill set when you think about how you make this material into something that's useful for batteries. So for example, The process, so you make a battery grade lithium. That then goes to a cathode maker. The cathode maker, combines the lithium with various other cathode materials depending on the cell chemistry, and then supplies that cathode material to a cell producer. So it's quite a complicated sort of industrial chemical supply chain. And in Germany, BASF are a cathode maker. Their cathode plant's 120 kilometers from our project site. The cathode plant in Poland, which is also relatively close by, and others around Europe. So, I think that's a little bit different to some other places where lithium is mined as a hard rock. So, the history of the industry has been, a lot of that kind of chemical processing has happened in China. So there's capacity built out there. And if you don't have it domestically, then it makes sense to kind of produce to a concentrate and ship it to that sort of ready-made market. In our case, that wouldn't make so much sense because we're a long way from China. Our deposit itself is a long way from the coast, but we're also in a kind of location where there actually is an end demand for the battery grade product. So, that's what's driving our strategy. I mean, the other thing I'd mention there is, Europe doesn't currently have any domestic supply of lithium. So, everything's currently imported from elsewhere, and that's kind of and that makes it strategically vulnerable and makes the industries that rely on it strategically vulnerable. So, there is something of an imperative to encourage and develop a local industry. So that's important as well.
Yeah, you raised several interesting points there. I'm unsure where to start. First of all, I just must ask you. So you've got a special type of mica ore, I think you mentioned, called zinnwaldite. Is that right? Did you say?
Correct, yes.
So that's the. Is that unique to your project, or is it just rare?
No, it's neither of those things really. So, I mean, there are a
Right.
number of other projects around Europe that are zinnwaldite projects. There's one in Spain. There are a couple in the UK. There's one very large project across the border from us in Czech. So there are a few other zinnwaldite projects around at the project development stage. So none of them are currently in commercial operation. It was discovered basically in the region we're in. So our deposit sits under the village of Zinnwald, which literally translates as tin forest because it was an area of tin mining for many hundreds of years. But the Zinnwaldite material was discovered there, and that's hence the name. But it's not unusual in that way.
So you're like, as the kids say, you're the OG of Zinnwaldite, you guys,
Exactly.
the original.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, so,
The
so
Hoover of Zinnwaldite.
yeah.
The Hoover of lithium, rather.
So, I mean, you talked about the dynamics there of the shipping to China and why it makes sense for you guys not to do that. I mean, I've heard criticism of some other European projects that, they pitch their marketing to investors as a European project, but actually their product is going to China, so it's sort of a bit, it doesn't all hang together, that marketing strategy, if you sort of really delve into it. So yours seems to make a lot more sense. And you mentioned BASF as the cathode maker, and then you also referred to a cell maker. I presume that when you say a cell maker, you mean a battery manufacturer. Is that correct?
Correct, yes. So there are a number of those. LG would be one. They have a big cell factory in Poland. But there's several other they call them gigafactories, I guess, now. So it's
Yeah.
trying to bring in scale and so on. But there are a number of those popping up or being developed around Europe. Northvolt was one example of a cell manufacturer that you know was attempting to get going. But you know, there are a number of more established players around as well.
And
And yes, so those cells go into a battery pack, and the battery pack is what goes into a car or a grid scale battery.
it's interesting you say that Europe still doesn't have any homegrown supply of lithium because, I mean, I can remember a time when lithium wasn't really talked about much in the mining space because there was less demand from it for it. But that is quite a long time ago now, and it might have been expected that at least one or two projects could have sort of made it into production by this time. What do you think are the factors that play into this this situation?
Well, I think it, you know, it's an industry that's grown tremendously relatively recently. So, I mean, in the kind of context of commodities generally, you know, if you even sort of scroll back, you know, 10 years, it was a very small industry. And in commodity terms, even now, it's not a massive industry. So, you know, it perhaps hasn't had the attention, you know, that some others have had. It's also, you know, for a number of reasons, been quite a volatile industry. So, you know, the price of lithium has, you know, has really been a bit of a roller coaster. That the overall, if you kind of zoom out and look at the overall trend, it's been, you know, a very upward trajectory, but it's the way it's got there has been, you know, with quite big oscillations, and that, you know, that adds to risk, and you know, and that then, you know, will affect people's willingness to invest. I mean, you know, it's also an element of kind of uncertainty and difficulty in predicting in demand. So, you know, EV adoption, you know, people were wildly optimistic at one point, you know, as and the growth rates were extremely high, but they're coming off a very low base. You know, as that sort of expands, kind of the true difficulties of rolling out, you know, that technology on a larger basis come to the fore, and you have, you know, different markets develop in different ways. So, you know, the US, for example, I think EV adoption is only at about 10% of new cars, whereas in China it's more like 50. In Europe it's closer to 20. So, you know, different regions develop at different paces, and I think that just makes it difficult for people to kind of commit the investment and the effort involved. I mean, the other thing is, you know, you've got to look at kind of the endowment of minerals, and you know, are they there in sufficient quantities to justify the sort of the downstream markets and so on, and certainly, you know, a number of the earlier projects in Europe are perhaps shorter, you know, are smaller resources and therefore have potentially shorter life. You know, we're not sort of coming through. We have a very large resource which would support a very long life, but that's a, you know, that's a relatively new thing.
Yeah, so I mean, you mentioned price just then. So let's touch on that briefly. It was a lot higher a couple of years ago, and there's been a perception around that it's actually quite tough for lithium companies, the developers, at the current pricing levels. First of all, what do you think about the way the lithium price moves and what drives it? And secondly, is it actually tough? I mean, do you guys find it a tough space to be in at the moment? How's it feel?
Look, it is tough. I mean, you have kind of the sort of almost psychological impact of you know, going from a very high price. So, I mean, but I sort of take a step back. The price that people often quote tends to be a spot price, and that, you know, represents a relatively small part of the overall market, where a lot more material is sold on long-term contract, where the pricing is much more kind of opaque or difficult to see, you know, as someone looking from the outside in. So that kind of, you know, very high price represented only a you know, a pretty small part of the market. So that's one thing. I mean, the other is You know, as I mentioned earlier, the long-term trend is very positive, but you know, kind of that volatility adds to a perception of risk. It makes it very hard for kind of finance providers to put a pin in kind of what the right long-term price is to properly evaluate projects. So, you know, it is a challenge. You know, coming back to sort of why it's been so volatile, I mean, I think part of it's because it is a small industry that's growing very, very fast. So, you know, supply tends to come on in chunks, whereas demand is kind of growing, you know, more smoothly, but at a fast rate. So, you know, what you'll find is, you know, supply comes on in kind of big chunks that then overshoot where demand is. So that adds to kind of the supply-demand imbalance, which adds to the volatility in price. The other thing is the inventory cycle. So you can hold, you know, players in the kind of the battery space and lithium space all hold inventory at different points. So you can hold it in the form of, you know, ore in the ground. You can hold it in the form of concentrate. You can hold it in the form of lithium carbonate. You can hold it in the form of cathode materials. You can hold it in the form of cells. You can hold it in the form of battery modules, and you can hold it in the form of cars or grid batteries. And you know how those find their way into the eventual market depends on kind of the approach of you know who's holding that in demand for you know for those things. You know it provides a lot of room for kind of pro-cyclical actions. So you know if prices are seen to be going up, people tend to increase inventory, which then drives prices even further up because it you know it creates a supply-demand imbalance in terms of a deficit of supply. And then you know when prices start to fall, people start to liquidate the inventory in order to preserve cash flow, which then accelerates the downward trajectory. So you know that you know that's a feature of the industry and has been you know one of the things that contributed to the collapse in prices from the you know very extremely high peak in 2022 to where we are now. But I would you know again I would say you know now is a low of the last few years, but it's you know much higher than where prices were in you know 2017, 2018, that sort of period. So you have to take a bit of historical context there.
And is there any danger of substitution? I read now and again about fancy new technologies, different types of batteries that are being developed. It all looks very complicated and too scientific for me to really get across. But is lithium sort of here to stay as the key component in electric vehicle batteries, for example?
So I think it is. I mean, obviously, I have a vested interest in saying that. But I mean, you know, you do often hear about other potential battery chemistries, whether it's kind of, you know, vanadium redox flow or sodium ion is one that you hear about a lot. I mean, lithium has some fundamental advantages. I mean, as I mentioned right at the beginning, if you look at the periodic table, it's the metal with the highest electrochemical potential. So, you know, you can't really beat that at a fundamental level. So it then comes down to price and performance on a number of metrics. You know, one of those metrics is energy density. Another metric is volumetric density. So how much the energy density is the energy that can be contained in a certain weight. So that's measured in watt hours per kilogram. Volumetric density is the amount of energy that can be contained in a certain volume of material. So it tends to be watt hours per liter. And then there are other metrics as well, you know, how it performs in cold weather, kind of risks like thermal runaway, so when the battery sort of heats up uncontrollably or things like that, so safety, and cycle life is another one. How many kind of cycles can a battery do? And those all contribute to the applicability, so the particular application. So if you're in a car or a drone or something like that, energy density and volumetric density is absolutely key, provided you can get enough cycles. For something like a grid scale battery, you know, volumetric density and energy density are less important because, you know, you care less about the weight if the battery's not moving around. But cycle life becomes, you know, one of the key things. So There are all of these things, and certain other chemistries will have certain advantages in terms of cost or something like that, but few of them can compete on kind of all of those things. So lithium ion, has a bit of an advantage. Now, when prices were up at kind of $70,000, $80,000 a ton of lithium, some of those other chemistries might have looked a lot more attractive. But with lithium pricing back in kind of a normal range, if you like, then those become a lot less attractive, and so the development of those technologies moves quite far off. And if you look at where kind of the sort of big battery producers have kind of spent their money and built their factories, it's all around lithium ion. So, and those investments need to be paid off. They're very large investments. They're not going to switch. It's unlikely that they would switch away from that at the drop of a hat. So, you would assume that creates a certain inertia in terms of the embedded technology. So it's not to say that there isn't a place for those other battery technologies, but I think that the basic advantages that lithium ion has will keep it at the forefront for many decades to come.
So you mentioned weight as part of that as part of that answer there. I mean, weight is a crucial issue with these batteries as they're quite substantial inside the electric vehicle, aren't they? They're actually a big part of the sort of volume and weight. Does lithium make up much of that volume and weight itself?
Oddly not. I mean, it's probably kind of 6 or 7% by weight of the battery pack. So it's actually a very small part. I mean, it's been described as the sort of seasoning in a salad. It's the vital part, but it's not the main kind of component by weight in a battery pack. So, I guess that creates some, protection to demand because it's not the main component in terms of cost. There are other aspects where producers will be more focused from a cost perspective. So it's a vital part, but it's not volumetrically the main part of a battery.
Yeah, so I mean, if a manufacturer was trying to make a battery smaller and lighter, he or she or they wouldn't be looking to cut down the amount of lithium, particularly as a first point of inquiry, anyway.
No. I mean, look, I mean, as the energy density of batteries improves, all materials, the bill of materials will go down, and lithium would be part of that. But the countervailing aspect of that is the less material, the lower the cost, which typically ends up improving demand. So you end up selling, if you could. As a just an example, if you could reduce the kind of the materials by 20%, costs by 20%, you probably push up demand by more than that 20%. So, I think you end up selling more batteries. And the other thing I would note is average battery size. So if we're looking at EVs, 5 years ago, perhaps the average kind of size of the battery in an EV was maybe 45 or 50 kilowatt hours. As energy density has improved, you can fit a bigger battery, which gives you more range into a car. That the average size has, in terms of energy content, has increased, and now it's maybe 65 or 70 kilowatt hours. So, there are those countervailing elements.
Yeah, it's an interesting area, and I imagine we'll see quite a lot of scientific progress in battery technology over the coming years. It really seems to be a hot area of interest.
Yeah, I mean, you've seen some really interesting things coming out of some of the big producers in China most recently. I mean, just last week, CATL, which is probably the biggest producer of lithium-ion batteries in the world, have announced a battery technology that allows significantly faster charging. So, being able to charge an EV in roughly similar time to what you'd fill up an internal combustion engine car with petrol. And that's, you know, is a bit of a game changer in terms of kind of the acceptability of the technology for that particular application. So, you know, I think there's, you know, we're relatively early on in these technologies at this kind of scale. It's difficult to see it getting worse. You know, whereas, you know, if you kind of compare it to engine, you know, combustion engine technology that's been developed for, you know, over 100 years, and, you know, it's somewhat reaching a logical limit. Electric vehicles, I think, are, you know, much earlier in that technology curve. And the consequence, you know, of the improvements, I mean, it's already a workable technology. There's some compromises you have to make, you know, but there's some real advantages. You know, that should only get better, which implies, you know, greater demand rolling forward. You know, so that's, I guess, where we come in. I mean, you're kind of coming back to kind of, you know, why we do this and why it's important. I think, you know, for regions that have industries that rely on these components, it is important to have some source of local supply. And I think the world we live in today has sort of amplified the need for that in terms of, you know, trade barriers and trade wars and rail wars and so on. So, you know, I think that's very important.
So let's talk about you guys for a minute in this context of the sort of broader lithium industry. So we've talked about how you're located in Germany, and you mentioned that you're not too far from a big city. Which city is that, and or how would you describe where you are in Germany?
Right, so we're in the former East Germany, so we're in the state of Saxony, and we're on the nearest large city to us is Dresden. So if you imagine a map of Germany, you've kind of got, if you look on the east side, you've got Berlin sort of towards the north, and then if you drop down to the sort of southern border with the Czech Republic, that's where Dresden is, and that's where our project is. So our project is basically on the border with the Czech Republic, kind of, you know, it's about 35 kilometers south of Dresden.
And so you guys are sort of across the way, so to speak, from the Kinnevik project.
Correct. Yes. I mean, it's, you know, it's effectively one large ore body that crosses the border. So it's, you know, it's all the same rocks effectively.
So you talked earlier about the fact that Zinwald plans to process on site. I think that would merit a little bit of a closer look from us, but perhaps it'd be worth just setting out the broad outlines of the project. So you've got lithium in Zinwaldite, 35 kilometers away from Dresden. How much lithium have you got, and what stage of development is the project at?
Sure. So, I mean, we recently put out a new resource statement. So we published that in June of last year, and that, you know, showed that we had a very significant resource, over 200 million tons, which makes us the second largest kind of hard rock lithium resource within the EU, third largest in Europe as a whole. So it's a very significant resource. In terms of the stage we're at, we recently published a pre-feasibility study. So we put that out at the end of March. And that showed kind of the potential scale of the project. So what we outlined in that was a two-phase project to kind of show the bookends of what the potential is. And that showed a few things. So one showed 18,000 tons lithium, sort of battery grade lithium hydroxide end production in phase one, and the potential to increase that to about 35,000 tons in a phase two. And even on that phase two scale, the size of the deposit would support production for over 40 years. So, you know, it's a multi-decade project, and that's very important in the context of the investment required, because, you know, as I mentioned earlier, you know, we're going all the way to a battery grade product. So, you know, when you look at the overall scale of the investment, The mine is obviously an important component of that, but actually the majority of the investment is in the processing facility. And so in order to justify that investment and justify developing a process to develop, what is a, slightly new form of lithium from a industrial processing point of view, you need scale and long life to justify that, and that's what we have. And then if you think about it in the context of kind of a strategic kind of resource or project, for Germany and the region, again, you want it to be, in order to justify doing this, it really needs to be something that can be there for a long time, so that downstream industries can rely on the fact that that source will be there for a very long time. And I think that's kind of some one of the things that distinguishes us from from some other projects that are out there that are much shorter life and make that sort of case a little bit harder.
And so what were the what did the numbers look like in terms of costs and potential returns?
Sure. So, I mean, kind of what the sort of headline numbers for the study showed, pre-tax NPV over 3 billion euros, a post-tax NPV 2.2 billion euros, a post-tax internal rate of return of just under 20%, so 19.8%. So cash cost just over 8,000 euros per ton. In the kind of middle of the cost curve, no European project is going to be, in the bottom quartile. But I think we're in a competitive position to be a long-term player. And key to that is being able to do everything as close to the resource as possible.
What is actually the lithium price today as we speak?
So it depends which kind of particular commodity you're looking at and where in the world you're looking at it, but it's sort of ranges between 11,000, 12, $13,000 dollars a ton. So it's much lower than it has been. In terms of trying to pick a long-term price, which is far more relevant for a project like ourselves, most of the kind of informed commentators, I would say, kind of looking at the industry, all sort of talk about incentive pricing, in the upper 20,000, so 25 to $30,000 a ton is what's really required to bring new production on stream. What everyone always says in the commodity industry is the cure for low prices is low prices, because it constrains new production, that creates a shortage, and then you have prices moving up. So it is in a low at the moment, but their expectation is that with end demand growing the way it is growing at close to 20% per annum, that oversupply situation can't continue indefinitely, and then we'll move into something driven more by the cost curve and incentive pricing, which is in that sort of the upper 20,000s. Per ton. So I think that's the view we would have. Exactly when that happens is anyone's guess really. But and everyone has a differing view. But we certainly see signs that the market has bottomed. Absent sort of broader economic headwinds. So if we run into a recession or whatever, that can change how quickly things turn around. But if we just kind of look at the underlying fundamentals, and if you say, okay, ultimately it's the marginal cost of production that will drive the ultimate price, because otherwise you just don't get the supply, then if you look across the world at costs, we think there's a lot of support, because the end of the cost curve rises quite steeply, that will support pricing returning to those incentive levels. So that's kind of how we see that. But obviously it's a difficult market right now, and that's reflected in equity value.
Sure. So when we're talking about lithium prices, are we talking about Li2O or the end products?
We're talking about the end products. So you'll see pricing most often quoted for lithium carbonate or lithium hydroxide. In our case, we'd be selling lithium hydroxide, and the price differential between lithium carbonate and lithium hydroxide moves around. Historically, lithium hydroxide, because slightly more processing involved, has typically traded at a slight premium to lithium carbonate. But as you get kind of imbalances in particular subsections of the market, that can move around. But that's the price you typically see is for those two commodities.
So is lithium hydroxide better than lithium carbonate, or is it just different?
It's just different. So in simplistic terms, lithium hydroxide is required for nickel-based battery chemistries. So that's historically what you found in more in EVs, because the energy density of a nickel-based battery is typically higher. It also has typically had better cold weather performance. And then the other sort of kind of primary battery technology is lithium iron phosphate, LFP batteries, which is something that Chinese battery makers have historically dominated. And that has other advantages and disadvantages. So it's typically lower energy density, its cold weather performance is not typically as good, but it's a more stable chemistry, so it doesn't suffer as much thermal runaway. And it's cheaper because the material, if you put the lithium aside, the other components of that battery chemistry are iron and phosphate, which are much cheaper than nickel and manganese and cobalt, which you would get in the nickel-based chemistry. So it has a cost advantage, but its uses and applications and regional markets tend to be a little bit different. It's a bit of a movable feast at the moment. I mean, interestingly, the flow sheet that we've developed and are refining goes via making a lithium carbonate to make a lithium hydroxide. So we actually do have flexibility to make one or the other. It's not something you switch on or off, but there is that possibility. So we're not necessarily committed to one or the other, but the European market at the moment is more weighted towards the nickel chemistries, and therefore lithium hydroxide is potentially the more attractive product to make. But that's something that's constantly under review.
So, am I right in gathering from what you just said there that the European battery makers are making more nickel batteries than the LFPs?
Correct. Correct. That's true at the moment. Yeah, I mean, whether that remains the case, we will have to see. But the majority of LFP production, LFP battery production, happens in China and the world today.
So that's the reason why you guys have gone for the hydroxide process route.
Correct. Correct. But as I say, there is some flexibility to change that, certainly at this point of our project development.
So there's no sort of chemical or mineralogical reason you could with the Zinwaldite, you could produce a concentrate if you so wished, and then you could
And then
produce
from there,
carbonate.
it depends, how you produce it. And a large part of our process, it's kind of the end of the process where you kind of have to pick the specific form. And so that it quite a lot of the process is common to both, and then it's at the end of that where you would need to define it. Look, you don't want to be making lots of different things, so it's a decision we would have to make at some point before finally pushing the button on the project. But there is that flexibility built in.
So presumably, from what you were saying earlier, there's a significant markup or margin enhancement in produce making a hydroxide product as opposed to just producing the concentrate and shipping it to China. And I wonder how that shows up in your pre-feasibility study, which you referenced a few minutes ago.
Well, I mean, it's kind of it is sort of built into the numbers and the returns, and doing everything on site as well is very important. So as you can imagine, kind of shipping shipping concentrate, halfway around the world is, picks up a significant additional charge, and then you have to have the kind of the producer's margins on top of that to convert the material. There's a certain amount of drying and reconstituting material and so on that that adds to the price if you have a kind of a distributed production chain. So I think those are real advantages. And then the other part of it is some of the side stream or waste materials from our production process will go back underground as backfill, which obviously improves the safety of the mined out areas. It's a way of dealing with those volumes. And so, that's something you want to have available to you very close to where you've mined it. You don't want to be moving this material, long distances away. So that's an important component of it as well. I think another aspect for us is there are sources of renewable energy in the region where we're planning to mine and process. So that ultimately has the potential to improve our cost position and also our kind of our CO2 content position. And that's for car makers and battery makers more generally, that CO2 content of the material is a pretty important part of the whole equation for them. And if you're shipping material around the world, obviously it picks up quite a lot of carbon content just from that transport element. So that's an important component for us as well.
Presumably, there's a reasonable amount of CapEx involved in adding the processing operation onto the mining operation.
100%, yes. It makes it a bigger project that obviously creates challenges from a financing point of view. But equally, does take out some risks in terms of where you will ultimately sell the product and it is adding margin because you're making a higher value product. But again, being in Europe, that that starts to be an advantage relative to mining, in riskier jurisdictions where deploying high levels of CapEx is, carries a much higher risk element. Doing it in Western Europe where it's it sort of property rights and so on are much more secure. Brings down the overall risk premium, or there's a countervailing reduction in risk premium for that. We think most projects in Europe really need to be integrated in order to be competitive. We're no different to that. We can't rely on shipping the stuff around the world. It just wouldn't really make any sense.
Is there any possibility in the sort of medium to longer term that you might actually end up being a sort of a hub for other smaller miners to send material to?
We have a very large kind of land package in terms of exploration properties ourselves, very prospective exploration properties in the area. And I think, that would probably be the priority for us. But in terms of developing the technology, I think that, has potential application for other projects around Europe. Whether we would seek to process where we are. The advantage we have and the reason we think it makes sense to do our project is it's a massive resource. It can support a large scale operation for a long time. So it doesn't need to be predicated on finding other sources of material. We have plenty of our own material, which, is a risk factor. There are some other projects in Europe and other parts of the world that are kind of simply converters. So they, you know, they're buying material in from third party sources, and well, the concept is to buy material in from third party sources and process that. But the real risk there is whether they'll be able to actually access those sources. And you know, the other element is every source is subtly different, right? So you know, if your process works for one, it doesn't necessarily work as efficiently for another, and so on. Whereas we can optimize, we have enough material to be able to optimize the process for that, and know that, you know, there will be sufficient material to run the operation for a very long time.
So the attraction of the project really is that it's sort of vertically integrated to a very significant level and in a safe jurisdiction. But let me just ask you
And
about
near an end market, and near a very important end market as well.
yeah. So let me ask you about the jurisdiction which contains this end market. There's a history of tin and tungsten mining you mentioned in the area, but in terms of the modern mining industry, I don't know if it's fair for me to say this, but I'm not sure that Germany is really in the sort of forefront of well-known mining jurisdictions in this day and age in which we live now. So tell us a little bit about what it's like to sort of go permitting in Germany and get local government support and liaise with the locals and any other sort of pertinent issues along those lines that you think might be interesting.
Sure. So look, I mean, you know, I guess, you know, one of the challenges, you know, if we start with kind of social acceptance, you know, one of the challenges of doing something anywhere in Europe is relative density of population relative to some other, I guess, of what you would perhaps more typically associate with mining jurisdictions. You know, so that's a factor to be taken into account, and something we take extremely seriously. So we, you know, have a lot of we spend a lot of time you know, trying to communicate with local communities. We've established you know, a visitor center, you know, where our deposit is. You know, we make our staff available to answer questions and so on. So we, you know, we take that very seriously, and we're trying to do a good job of that. When it comes to permitting, so within Germany, there's a federal mining code, Mining Act, which sort of sets out the requirements. But the actual permitting authority is the state in which you're in. So in our case, it's Saxony, and that's the overarching permitting authority for our project. You know, which is good, because you have, you know, one kind of coordinated response to the permitting challenge. And you're absolutely right. People don't typically associate you know, Germany with mining activity. And I would argue that's, you know, with the exception of, you know, maybe some of the Scandinavian countries where there's been more recent mining activity, that's pretty common to the EU. But I mean, you know, that said, you know, the area has been mined for a long time, so people are familiar with the notion of mining. There was a large scale underground tin mine, basically located, you know, extremely close to where our project is, that operated into the 90s. It shut down on German reunification. So in the relatively recent history, there's been large scale mining in the area, so people kind of know what it means and what it can be. I mean, you know, one of the challenges for us is, you know, mining practices have improved significantly since that time, and you know, communicating the fact that, you know, it's safer now and has far more kind of cognizance of environmental impact is, you know, one of our challenges to communicate. But in terms of other, I mean, you know, there was an underground tin mine that received a permit very recently. It was late last year, you know, not that far away from us. And there are some other mining activities in the state, you know, not too far away. So, you know, there has been quite recent activity. You know, we're not far from the town or the city of Freiburg, which has a large university, and of which the kind of mining faculty is a significant part. So, you know, again, system of representation of the importance of mining in the area. And then finally, the government of the state of Saxony has been very, very supportive of us. I mean, when we published our PFS, they published a very supportive statement, basically making the point that, the project has real significance for the region, can be an important economic contributor to the region, can be an important contributor in terms of jobs, and then ultimately the sort of downstream industries that they're interested in promoting and supporting. So that was a very strong statement. We were very happy to see that, and we think we have a good relationship there.
So what's
And
next?
then finally, I would say, and so, sorry, just to finish off on that. I mean, obviously, when you look at the potential importance of this for Germany, I mean, the car industry is a massive contributor to the German economy, as is the chemical industry. So, it's if you believe in the transition to EVs, then I think the kind of that importance is fairly clear.
So what's next for you guys? You've got your pre-fees out into the world. Presumably you're sort of moving forwards towards tightening up those numbers into something even more precise.
Correct. I mean, it's all about moving stepwise and trying to de-risk the project. So next step for us is some test work that will culminate in running various continuous pilot runs. So in order to kind of fully understand both the risks and ultimately the costs associated with the chosen processing route, you can't ever sort of underestimate how much test work it's sensible to do, and to try and run that on on something that replicates what it would be under industrial continuous conditions is important. So we need to do that work, and then that flows into the next level of study, which is a definitive feasibility study, which we would intend to complete during 2026. That then provides the basis for the full financing of the project. It defines things on a more accurate basis than a pre-feas does. So a pre-feas, as I'm sure you're aware, what it allows you to do is kind of put a very sort of complex project in a fairly complete form, which allows you to kind of see what the bottlenecks are, what the challenges are, in sufficient detail that you then can optimize it. And it also allows you to run sort of various trade-offs between different options. So you kind of go, okay, now I know what the real constraints are, whether it's space, whether it's dealing with waste, whether it's cost of energy, whether it's whatever it is. The only way you can determine exactly what the bottlenecks are is through a detailed enough study of the projects as a whole, which is what the pre-feas attempts to do. And then you kind of take that and go, okay, these are the areas we need to work on more, optimize for those, and that's and then also do the engineering, et cetera, to a far higher degree of accuracy. So it's all about trying to remove as much risk from the processes as possible. So that next step for us is that it's first the kind of the test work, trying to sort of optimize things so that we kind of work through what the pre-feas highlighted in terms of challenges and opportunities, i.e. where we where things could get better if we optimize them, challenges we have to deal with. That all rolls into the FS, which obviously is a big piece of work and will take a reasonable amount of time.
And what about offtake agreements? So that is that something that is relevant here?
It's relevant for any commodity. It's particularly relevant to financing. I mean, our strategy on offtake has really been, it's a strategic asset of the business, and the value of an offtake agreement increases the closer you are, the more certainty you have to realizing a project. So there are projects out there where they've signed offtake agreements relatively early on, and we think if you really kind of look into the detail of those, they don't necessarily provide that much actual assistance for the project. There are too many outs for the offtaker. So it's kind of becomes a little bit of a free option for the offtaker and not that much benefit for the producer for the project. So we would prefer, to the extent possible, to kind of delay signing that offtake until we're further advanced with the project, because we think it'll have more strategic value at that point. But that's not to say we don't speak to potential off-takers. Of course we do. Always making them aware of the scale of the project, what it can be, working up more precise details on the quality, air quality of what the product will be, and that kind of thing. But more information and more certainty means more value for that.
Presumably, though, you'll be able to price your product very competitively for the local market because, as we've been talking about throughout the course of this conversation, you're just located right there, whereas most other people will be shipping product from somewhere else.
Yeah, that's exactly right, and especially in the case of lithium hydroxide, it's not a product that travels especially well, in the sense that it can degrade in the environment. So it has to be stored in inert conditions and all of this kind of thing. So you can't store it for an extended period of time without it degrading. So being kind of close to a producer is a useful thing for a cathode maker or a battery cell maker. It's also if you're close to your supplier, issues like Suez Canal getting blocked by a freighter sort of getting caught, that has happened a few years ago. Those sort of things can upset global supply chains, especially if they're all kind of done on a just-in-time basis. So, I think having some local suppliers is very key. And on that topic, I mean, even if all of the European lithium projects come on stream, it still won't supply all of European demand. So I think, there will be an advantage to being a local supplier.
Absolutely. So,
And, you know,
sorry, go on.
I was just going to say, I mean, another aspect of that, which is, not totally clear now, is how carbon gets priced and what the carbon border adjustment mechanism is going to be. And I think, there will be advantages from that perspective to being a local supplier relative to someone in the rest of the world.
What you mentioned that lithium hydroxide can degrade. What does it actually look like? Or what
It
can
looks like a white, powder. In fact, I don't know if you can see that,
Yeah.
but that's a sample of lithium hydroxide made from one of the sort of early process runs we did. So it's like a white sort of fine powder in its pure form.
And presumably it doesn't degrade once it's inside a cathode.
No. So at that point, no. I mean, batteries, do degrade over time more because they get charged and discharged. But I think what's interesting is now that you're getting electric vehicles that have been on the road for some time and doing significant mileage, I think what's transpired from that is that the batteries actually last a lot longer than perhaps people anticipated early on. So that's important because it reassures people buying cars. But you're constantly reading about people buying Teslas or other cars that have got a couple of 100,000 kilometers on the clock, and the battery's totally fine. I mean, there is some degradation, but not a significant amount. No, it's more whether the material itself is exposed to the air, that's when it oxidizes and it can degrade more rapidly. So it's more in its kind of unprocessed. It's not unprocessed, but unprocessed into a battery. Or is what I mean.
Right. Well, I guess we're getting to the point where we ought to wrap this up, Anton. Before we go, maybe I could just ask you to dish out some advice. What advice would you give to investors who might be considering, investing in the lithium space? What are the things to look out for, both the pitfalls and the possible attractions?
Look, I mean, I think, I guess sort of, timing is ever an important element to any commodity investment. That's where I think kind of long-lived assets, tend to have an advantage. I sort of started my early days in the mining industry, one of the big mining companies. We always looked at having operations of 21 years plus, and the reason for that is, conventional wisdom sort of said, like a typical commodity cycle is 7 years, and so if you don't, if you have 21 years, that's three cycles. So you will get the kind of the real option value of those peaks, multiple times. Whereas if you've got a very short life operation, when it comes into operation is absolutely critical to the average return that you'll earn on it. If if your project only has a 10 or 11 year life, that's kind of one cycle. And if you time it wrong, that cycle can happen very late in its life, and therefore you don't really get that value. But if you have a very long life operation, you get a lot of bites at that cherry. So that's something. Kind of the relative importance that a project has to the region it's in terms of kind of economic contribution, fit with other industries, all of that kind of thing obviously plays into how likely it is to ultimately be realized. So that's something to consider as well. And then it's just value relative to long-term value, and kind of look at, okay, often I think, call it a mistake, but something that a lot of investors in commodities might do is they rush into commodities when prices are high and they're hot, but that's obviously price values tend to be quite high at that time as well. So I think there is a return to being a little bit contrarian and kind of go, okay, is this industry suffering a bit because prices are low? What are the chances of that improving? Is now a good value time to actually place some bets and say, okay, these are the projects we think, projects or assets that we think will, well positioned to do well when the market turns, and that value could be quite, or price could be quite different when the market turns. So let's look at them now. So that's something I would say as well, is try and think through where these things could be. Recognize there's risk in that, but that's a value opportunity.
Well, we'll be watching you guys with interest over the coming years, and especially 2026 seems to be the key year for the DFS. But there's plenty to look forward to this year as well. We'll hopefully see some sort of uptick in the lithium price in the not too distant future, and everybody can take two or three cheers about that. But thanks for your time today, Anton. It's been really great talking to you, and thanks for telling us all about lithium and about Zimwald.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.